Thank you for downloading the podcast. This week my guests were Jude Kelly and Gillian Moore from the South Bank Centre and the singer Tom Jones. This is Classic FM, and I'm delighted to say my guest this week on the Culture Club is the singer Tom Jones, who's been a real hero of mine most of my life, actually, Tom, so it's wonderful to meet you.
Thank you.
Now, you've got an autobiography which has come out, and
yes,
it's called Over the Top and Back. Why have you written it now, at this stage in your career?
One of the reasons is that there's been a lot of other books put out about me, and they've only been put together from interviews that I've done. You know, so the people from Penguin Books came to me and said, why don't you write your own story? You have so many wonderful stories and where you come from. You know, the South Wales coal mining background and to where you've become a worldwide entertainer. And all those stories, there must be a million stories that you have. And I said, well, it is. and that's what, you know, all the rest of the stuff has been written about. There's got to be something. When somebody becomes successful,
yes,
there's a reason for it. They forget what is the thing that makes that man or woman tick.
Yes.
What do they feel about the talent and how much luck was involved and things like that. So there's a lot of interest in what is the real Tom Jones. And I want people to know that.
And you write very movingly about your childhood in Pontypridd. I mean, it's very evocative, added to which are these wonderful black and white photographs as well, which sum up the period.
Yes.
Where did the impulse to sing come from?
Well, apparently I was born with it. My mother said I could sing before I could walk. I used to crawl around the kitchen singing. You know, the radio would be playing and I would be singing along with it, apparently. And so it's always been there. Ever since I was a child, it was a thing that was so natural. It was like breathing to me. So I would sing any chance I got. Weddings and birthday parties and everything.
Yes. Now, was it difficult to dredge up the memories? I mean, you've had such an extraordinary life and so varied.
Mm-hmm.
Did you keep a diary or were you able to access those memories quite easily?
I can access them very easily because I think maybe I've got a sort of kind of a photographic memory. Because when I think of things, I can see them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're there. And that's how I learn songs, funny enough. I read the lyrics, I get the lyrics.
Yes.
But once the song, the story of the song is in my mind, I see it.
And what is it about Wales and singing? Why are there so many extremely talented Welsh singers?
Because that's the way it is. it's a thing that I don't know, really. Because coal miners, you know, they used to come out of the coal mines and they formed these male voice choirs. So singing is second nature there. But I noticed, because I come from a large family, you know, as far as aunties and uncles and cousins.
Yes.
You know, and we would always get together on weekends. So you were encouraged to sing.
Yes.
And I loved it. And one of my cousins was asked, well, what was different about Tommy, you know, thinking that she was going to say, my voice.
Yes.
But she said, well, the difference with Tommy when he sang, he had to get on the table. You know what I mean? As with most children, you know, they stand in the corner.
Exactly, they'd be very shy.
Yeah, but apparently I was. So I thought that was funny.
Now, an important part of your childhood, in a way, was that you were ill for 2 years with TB.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you write very movingly about the isolation of that and that real sense of looking out of the window and life was going on without you. I found that incredibly poignant. Do you think that changed your perspective on life? Did you
say
to yourself, I must grab the chances that come my way?
Definitely. It's a thing that, you know, when people have experiences in their life, hopefully you can gain something from it.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, it made me realise. And that's the only time I couldn't sing. The doctor said, don't sing.
Oh, you couldn't. They wouldn't let you.
They wouldn't let me, no. I couldn't do anything physical. So I learned to draw a lot. I used to draw, sketch things and like that. And I learned to play the ukulele a bit.
Yes.
But, you know, so I would it would be music and stuff, but I couldn't actually sing. So that was very frustrating.
It must have been,
But I listened to the radio a lot, so I picked up a lot of information. But I learned something from it. You know, I learned to appreciate life, I think,
yes,
more than if I hadn't had TB, and it stopped me from going into the coal mine because my father was a coal miner, and maybe I would have, you know, gone into the coal mine.
That's a very interesting point, actually. Mm. Yes, you may well have done and followed him down the mine.
Yeah, so it was like a blessing in disguise, really.
And yet, isn't it extraordinary, because you were told you had weak lungs.
Yes.
And but look at the wonderful career you've had.
I know.
And the voice that you've got.
Yes, and my lung capacity.
And, you know,
it's like, yes, it's very strange. But maybe that 2 years might have helped. They might have strengthened my lungs, who knows?
Quite possibly. Who were the big musical influences on you when you were growing up at that stage in your life?
Yeah, well, it was mostly American music, of course, you know, but I liked Mahalia Jackson.
Mm.
You know, I thought, how come in our church they don't sing like that? And she must have rubbed off on me, but apparently I was bending notes and putting some inflections in there that were not there. So they couldn't quite believe it, that this young Welsh boy was singing the blues or singing gospel like somebody from the southern states of America, you know. So I was being influenced without really realising it.
And it must have been something instinctive within you as well, your
yes.
musicality, that you responded in that way.
Exactly, because, and, you know, you pick up on things.
Yes.
Everybody
yes.
heard Mahalia Jackson sing.
Yeah.
You know, she was
yes.
on the radio a lot. And then when rock and roll kicked in, for instance, I thought all kids of my age were affected by it.
Mm.
But no, because these, I have two girl cousins, they're twins, and one of those are the ones that said, Tom used to like to jump on the table. Anyway, they would sing Sister, you know, Sister,
yes.
Sister.
Yeah.
You know. So musicals were big to a lot of people, but not to me. You know, I mean, I was listening to blues and gospel and country, and then rock and roll kicked in, and I
yes.
thought, my God, this is it. I thought that was going to wipe the floor with everything. And it did for a short while, you know, but then,
yes.
you know, then the other stuff started creeping back in again.
And you also had a good friendship with Elvis Presley.
Yes.
Which you write about. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. Well, when I first went over to do an Ed Sullivan show in early 65, that's when It's Not Unusual came
yes.
out. I did some in New York, because that's where the Ed Sullivan show was. And then it went to colour. You know, the TV went to colour.
Yes.
So they couldn't transmit in colour in New York. So they had to go to Los Angeles to use the facilities. So that gave me the opportunity then to go to Los Angeles. Mm. And Elvis Presley was at Paramount Studios. And I had to go there to talk about a song for a film that never happened. But while I was there, they said, Elvis is filming today and he'd like to say hello. Well, I didn't know that he knew that I existed. I had It's Not Unusual, What's New Pussycat, and a ballad called With These Hands. And when I met Elvis on the set, he had stopped filming and he was walking towards me, singing With These Hands, you know, which was my record.
Oh.
And he's, you know, it was like he's pointing at me. He's got this thing with his hand, you know, With These Hands, I will clearly, and I'm thinking, Jesus, you know, Elvis Presley's walking towards me, singing my song. You know, the boys back home won't
yes.
believe it.
Yes.
And but it was true. And he said, "How do you sing like? How do you sing like that?" I said, "Well, you are partly to blame, you know."
He asked you a rather poignant question, I thought, at one stage. He said, "What do you take to stay sane?"
Yes.
Which actually rather sad.
It is sad. You know, that was the. He felt that he had to take drugs
yes.
in order to survive. And I realised that, no. You, if you want to survive, you don't. I mean, I've always liked to drink.
Mm.
I was brought up drinking, you know, in South Wales, you know, they're big beer drinkers. And I was brought up with that. And I like alcohol.
Mm.
So that was enough for me. You know, that was in order to control that, know when to have a drink and when not to.
Yes.
You know, you can't do it. You cannot drink and then try to go on stage and sing. It doesn't work. I did try it, but it doesn't work. So I learned my lesson. So drinking to me was a social thing and
yes.
a way to relax. And
yes.
and then I got to like Cuban cigars, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't think so. At the beginning, when I first came to London, I was smoking cigarettes and drinking pints of beer.
Yeah.
And my manager, Gordon Mills, said, oh, you'll be drinking champagne and smoking Cuban cigars. I said, no, I won't. Well, yes, I do.
Does classical music play any part in your life? Does it interest you?
Some of it does. You know, I like certain, because a lot of movies that are made, they take, you know, the commercial parts of, you know, pieces of wonderful classical music. Like my favorite piece of music is the Concerto de
Aranjuez.
Concerto de Aranjuez by Rodrigo. So that piece of music, it knocks me out. I mean, it did the first time I heard it, and I've heard a lot of classical guitarists play it, and then, of course, the full orchestra comes in. And it's tremendous, and that always... So I think it's a Spanish flavour that excites me with
it. That appeals to you, yes. Yeah. It is actually a great favourite on Classic FM. People often ask for it to be played. Mm. I also want to ask you about appearing at the South Bank Literary Festival. You're going to be talking about your autobiography.
Yes.
How will that feel, sitting there talking about a book rather than actually standing up and singing?
Well, it'll be new for me.
It will. It'll be a very novel experience.
So that's exciting, because I like to try new things. And it's going to come natural, because I love to talk and I love to sing. So we could get those two things together. I think it would be more interesting night than if I just went on and did a show like I normally do.
Yes.
Or if I just went on and spoke for an hour. I think to sort of speak about something worthwhile, which I think this book is, and the album that goes with it. So we can do both. You know, I can talk about the book, and people can ask me questions about different... chapters and everything, and then I can do the songs that fit with it, really. It's a soundtrack of the book.
Yes, yes. Mm. At the end of the book, well, and indeed throughout the book, you write very warmly about your wife, Linda.
Yes.
And you pay a wonderful tribute to her at the end, and she's obviously been the rock throughout your life. You even go so far as to say that you might not be able to continue singing were she not around. Tell me a little bit about Linda.
We were children together, you see. She went to a Catholic school and I went to a Protestant school, but that was the only difference. I remember seeing her for the first time because I thought Catholic girls were exotic. They were more exotic than Protestant girls. I think one of the reasons, because they had earrings. You know, they wear earrings at such an early age. And I used to look at her, you know, she would play marbles and she had these earrings, you know, great legs. But anyway, I was attracted to her when I was a kid. And she said she was attracted to me as well. And then, but I went to bed for 2 years, you know, with TB. So that sort of knocked me out of the sort of trying to make an impression on her. I remember we'd had Kiss Chase, you know, and I kissed her behind this place called the Black Shed. And she said, you know, the boys were kissing all the girls. You know, you chase them, and if you caught them, you kiss them. But she said, when I kissed her, it was different. And I felt the same way about her. But I had to sort of take a break because of the TB thing. But I thought about it all the time, and I used to watch her go up the mountain, you know, from the window. So she's always been part of my life. And I say at the end of the book, like when Elvis said, what drug do you take, and how do you stay sane? And I say at the end of the book, I wish I'd have told him I have Linda, you know. Because he told me, Elvis Presley, he said, you were lucky because you fell in love at an early age and you held on to your first love. And he said he had fallen in love with a girl when he was young, but he went out onto the road and she went with somebody else. Mm. And that was the big loss of his life.
Yes.
He told me that. And so we always, when he would see Linda come into the dressing room, you know, and when we'd go back to his suite, he gave her gifts, you know. He gave her a lovely necklace, and he used to say to Mark, you know, my son who would be with us, take care of your mama, Mark. You know, Mark, take care of your mama now. You know, because he loved his mother.
Yes.
And so she's been with me all the time. And I had a scare with her a few years ago. She had colon cancer, and they had to cut it out, you know, so she didn't have to take any chemo or anything. They just cut it out and they got it. But I was very, very worried. I thought, my God, how can I sing if she dies? How can I step on the stage and sing about life? Because when I get into songs on stage, I get emotional, you know, and these pictures flashing in my eyes. And I thought, I don't think I'll be able to do it. You know, so then I realized how important this woman has been to me all my life, you know, and still is, thank God.
Well, as I say, you write incredibly movingly about her, and it's rather a wonderful end to the autobiography.
Mm.
Tom, this has been an enormous pleasure for me, and I'm sure for our audience as well. Thank you ever so much for coming in and talking
to me.
My
pleasure.
Charlotte Green's Culture Club on Classic FM.
Third movement, the finale of Brahms' Piano Concerto No. 1. The soloist was Daniel Barenboim, and Staatskapelle Berlin was conducted by Gustavo Dudamel. Well, as part of Classic FM's South Bank Centre Week, I'm joined in the studio by Jude Kelly, who's the artistic director of the South Bank, and Gillian Moore, who's the music director. Welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you.
Now, let's talk about Barenboim, Dudamel and Brahms. Gillian, that looks to me like a great concert. In fact, I'm going to be there because I've already booked my tickets, but that's going to be a real highlight, isn't it?
Yes, well, Daniel Barenboim has a really strong relationship with South Bank Centre and the Royal Festival Hall because when he was 14 years old in 1956, he gave his first UK concert there, and he's really had a special affection for the place ever since, and I'm so pleased that he's got this relationship. So he asked us specially if we'd arrange a concert with his friend Gustavo Dudamel conducting so that he could celebrate the 60th anniversary of his debut in the UK with us. So it's going to be wonderful.
And two towering musical personalities, aren't they? It's wonderful that they're coming together to play together.
Yes, the thing about Barenboim, of course, is he's very generous, and he's such a human being in the world, and he's an advocate for human rights and for education as well. So he really does mentor younger musicians. So Gustavo Dudamel is one of perhaps the most distinguished musicians that he has that sort of mentor relationship with. So it'll be really interesting to see Gustavo conducting, Daniel Barenboim playing the piano, and that relationship playing out in that particular way.
It'll be fascinating. Jude, the South Bank Centre presents a huge range of arts and cultural programmes and performances. I wonder, what are your particular highlights? What are the things you're looking forward to most?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that we pay a lot of attention to the heritage of the South Bank Centre, which is the Festival of Britain. And it was this extraordinary moment when we said in this country, the arts, culture, can be the method by which people can come together to celebrate humanity and tolerate each other, include each other, listen to different kinds of voices. And so I would say the driving point of South Bank Centre is to get people through festivals to create this idea of inclusion, which can sound politically glib, but actually it's incredibly important. And so, you know, the things that I love, I mean, Gillian's just given an example, really, where two people from different backgrounds and different life circumstances, but both loving music, come together and support each other, the younger and the older, etc. But to give an example of something which we're doing, which brings together people with no knowledge and people with huge knowledge, we're this year looking at Wagner's Ring Cycle. And this is a really important thing. It's a festival, really, of the ring. Now, Opera North did a superb Ring Cycle, and we're bringing that to London. But around it, we're creating a number of ring schools where people who have never heard of the ring or who've heard a little bit about it but not quite sure what it means or how to get into it can become part of understanding this huge and wonderful work.
That sounds absolutely fascinating. Gillian, I wanted to ask you about your new role, because you're now the Director of Music, and you were made Director of Music in March, I think, this year. I just wondered what your new responsibilities are.
My new role involves really being responsible for all music at South Bank Centre. So that means classical music, which is where my training lies. But like most people, you know, I grew up loving a whole range of all kinds of music. And at South Bank Centre, we've always presented pop music, jazz music. So many of the jazz greats have come through the Royal Festival Hall and the other halls, and also music from all around the world. So it's very exciting to be able to think about the direction of all music at South Bank Centre, and also about who gets to come. You know, we don't just think about the art itself. We also think about who's it for, who already will come anyway, but who might come if they only knew about it.
Yes.
And that's something that I'm very passionate about too.
Well, we're going to hear some music by Sibelius now. This is the Symphony No. 5, the third movement. The third movement, the finale of the Symphony No. 5 by Sibelius, played by the London Philharmonic Orchestra under the baton of Jukka-Pekka Saraste. I'm Charlotte Green and you're listening to The Culture Club on Classic FM, and we're celebrating the South Bank Centre all week, and you can find out more about our special programmes at classicfm.com. And I'm joined in the studio by Jude Kelly and Gillian Moore. Now, the Philharmonia are going to be performing the Fifth Symphony by Sibelius, I think on November the 1st, conducted by Esa-Pekka Salonen. It's their 70th anniversary year. What are the particular strengths of the Philharmonia?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that David Welton, who's been their general director for many, many years, I think over 30 years, is about to retire. I would like to just use this opportunity to pass an accolade his way, because it's an amazing thing to have been in that position and to have kept an orchestra operating internationally and nationally to such a superb effect all that time. When they brought Esa-Pekka Salonen to be the principal conductor, actually that also changed the tone of the orchestra, because he's such an advocate for contemporary music and he's such an adventurous conductor. And I think that's its strength. It's been able to keep its traditional audience, but it's been able to go into new ground. And the particular thing that's now become quite famous for is its digital platforms, where it's looking at how its education work and its work generally is able to go worldwide, not necessarily live, but through very innovative digital platforming.
I think what's really exciting about that is that digital thing that you'd mentioned, is that the Philharmonia started off in just after the war as an orchestra dedicated to new technology. It was a recording orchestra. They've always been at the forefront of the latest technology. And now, with Esa-Pekka Salonen, they're doing digital installations, apps, downloads.
They're really still there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all part of their tradition.
Yes. Gillian, I wanted to ask you about encouraging children and young people in to listen to classical music. I just wondered how do you make classical music more cool, I suppose, really, more acceptable? I mean, I often notice sometimes around here, when I come into the studios, there was a huge crowd outside for One Direction. And I just know that even if you got someone, you know, a really cool young classical musician, there wouldn't be the same number of people waiting outside to mob them. What can be done?
Well, we do actually have crowds and crowds of young people coming to South Bank Centre. We have our local schools, our local music services use South Bank, we use the Royal Festival Hall as performance spaces. All of our resident orchestras put on concerts for schools and family concerts. We do cater for audiences of all ages, and it's very important. We have a festival called Imagine, which is for children. We have a festival called Why, which is what's happening for the young. We also have a teenage festival. So we really do try to think, not just, some people have said to me, oh yes, it's important to work with young people because they're the audiences of the future, but they are the audiences of now as well. Yes. And they have needs and desires, and they're just as excited by music as I am. So we just have a responsibility to keep offering a wide variety of programmes.
I think there's several things that could be better. I think that our education system doesn't help children understand that we value complexity and that art is there to support humans being complex, which we are. Mm-hmm. And therefore, when a piece of work is difficult and needs negotiating and needs unearthing in terms of its full meaning, that's like a novel. You know, it's something which we have to learn to do.
Yes.
And I think that we need to put music back into the centre of our, not just our public schools, but our state schools. And it's very patchy, that. So that's number one. The second is that, obviously, the pop industry focuses on sex appeal.
Yes.
And, you know, that's a lively part of human experience. It's very difficult and peculiar when that happens in classical music. It's often done for girls, isn't it?
Of course,
you know,
yes,
girl violinists in red dresses and
exactly.
so on. But I do think that we need to encourage our conductors and our soloists to become more public in platforms that they take to speak out passionately about music and to become personalities that people recognise.
Yes. Now, we're going to hear the Maltese tenor Joseph Calea. He's performing at the South Bank in January, I think, singing songs and arias by Verdi. But we're now going to hear him singing Puccini. Your Tiny Hand is Frozen from the opera La Bohème by Puccini, sung by Joseph Calea with the orchestra of the Swiss Romande, conducted by Marco Ammiliato. And as I said earlier, he'll be at the South Bank in January singing songs and arias by Verdi. This is Charlotte Green's Culture Club on Classic FM, and my guests are Jude Kelly and Gillian Moore. Jude, I want to ask you about funding for the arts, because that is a regular hot topic. Do you have concerns about the future funding outlook?
Well, one of my concerns is that we need to keep remembering as a nation that, first of all, the UK is probably the most celebrated in the world for its creativity and its cultural output, which for a small island is extraordinary, and that that happens not by magic, but by investment. And whether you were talking about investment in science or manufacturing or digital, the same applies to creativity. If you invest, the rewards will be both commercial and philosophical. So we mustn't squander this reputation by being parsimonious about investment. I don't really like the word subsidy because it suggests that somehow, you know, we need handouts. And it's not that. It's that you're investing in talent and you're investing in diversity and you're investing in access, and that produces an intelligent, sophisticated, interesting nation of people who then go on to be, you know. So that's my advert for the whole thing. Am I worried about it? Well, it's interesting because I actually think that George Osborne is a man who does understand and like culture. I just came back from China with a group of my sort of, you know, peers, and we were all there as part of the Economic Forum with George Osborne talking about the importance and relevance of culture. So I'm optimistic that politicians are beginning to really be less afraid of backing culture. You know, they're not necessarily listening as much anymore to the voices saying, well, you better not say you're interested in culture in case people think you're a bit wet or, you know, whatever. But we should never take our foot off the accelerator. Mm. And while there are young people or many people in the UK who still have been made to feel through history and economics that culture's not for them, there's an awful lot more to do.
Mm. Gillian, we talked earlier about Gustavo Dudamel and Daniel Barenboim and these, you know, huge musical personalities. Are there any other performers who are going to be at the South Bank in the coming year who really appeal to you?
Well, something that's a very important thread to what we're doing this year, this season at South Bank Centre, is opera in the concert hall. So we've just had Wozzeck from Zurich Opera, but we're also going to have Janufa by Janáček, which is performed by the Czech Philharmonic with an all Czech cast, apart from the great Finnish soprano Karita Matala. Ah. And we've also got the Magic Flute in the concert hall with the Budapest Festival Orchestra leading up to the Ring Cycle, which we've talked about. And I think there's something very powerful about the idea of opera in the concert hall, because you can make your own production in your head. You can actually imagine, you can use your imagination in a very powerful way and be told the story through the music. I'm also very enthusiastic about the fact that we're continuing our chamber music series, and the artists, the kind of artists that are coming to that include the Labeck sisters and Victoria Mulova and Patricia Kopaczynskaya. Perhaps it's coincidental, but we do have quite a strong representation of women musicians, of great women musicians. And we end that series this year at St. John Smith Square with a weekend called Deep Minimalism, where we feature some extraordinary composers, such as Pauline Oliveros and Daphne Oram, most of whom are female, as it happens. But we're really looking at a kind of aesthetic thing.
But when you say it's coincidental, I mean, that's probably not quite true, is it? Because we have noticed that right across the arts, you know, if you're looking at the canon, it's because of history and opportunity, women have not been the storytellers or not been forefronted as the storytellers, and we want to make a difference to that now. And, you know, both myself and Gillian have been very dedicated to conversations with all kinds of musicians about how women can have both the confidence and the support to be seen and heard. And I think that is changing. So this particular year, I think by highlighting so many women, I think that the conversations are becoming much riper about this whole territory.
Well, that's a very good and encouraging note to end on. Thank you very much indeed to both of you, Jude and Gillian. And we're now going to hear Chilly Gonzalez, who'll be doing his biggest UK show to date on the 7th of November at the South Bank Centre. Thank you for downloading the podcast. Next week, I'll have a book special with the writers Wilbur Smith, Martina Cole, and Sebastian Folkes. So I do hope to see you then.